It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pittsburgh has been repeatedly touted as one of America's most livable cities, but we're finding that that's only partly true. A report by the University of Pittsburgh highlights the racial disparities affecting the quality of life for Pittsburgh's black community. Among the findings, black and Hispanic unemployment rates are much higher than those of white and Asian residents. A significantly higher number of blacks live in poverty compared with whites. And in the Pittsburgh area, blacks have much higher death rates than whites from cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes. And they also lack health insurance in greater numbers. The report was funded by the Heinz Endowments and the Pittsburgh Foundation with additional support from Pitt's School of Social Work. Here to address the report's findings is Larry Davis, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work and Director of its Center on Race and Social Problems. He joins us now in Studio A. Dean Davis, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. This is a follow-up report, Dr. Davis, a status update, if you will, on a report that goes back to 2007. So we're looking at something that was originally brought up 8 years ago, which spelled out these disparities. So what, if anything, has changed?
Well, the most striking thing perhaps about the study is how little has changed. In some respects, though, it's perhaps not so surprising. It's sort of like Einstein's comment that if we continue to do the same thing and we expect something different to happen, you know, it's insanity. It's not going to happen. Not enough has changed structurally in the city to have caused some major change in these outcomes.
And so what is the real story here? What are we looking at?
The real story is that Pittsburgh is really not so unlike much of America. The other major cities, Chicago, Detroit, or, you know, I try to tell people with this study not to get too hung up in the absolute numbers, but keep the big picture in mind that we want to be a better city than other cities, and we taught ourselves as being a great city, and we are in some respects. But we really have a lot of work to do with regards to these inequities across all the seven areas that are outlined in the report.
And upon release of the 2007 report, various local officials stated okay, we've identified a problem. This is a starting point for policymakers and others to work on addressing disparities. Why hasn't it happened?
Well, you know, people in part have vested interest in things staying as they are. You know, when I first started out, I'm really trained as a psychologist. And I looked for attitudes. I thought, well, people were, you know, were racist and people were – and some of those things made sense. But a lot of it's advantage that much of what we see in our world and certainly everywhere is that people are working for their own advantage. And there's reasons why people don't want to change because they benefit from the existing situation. Their people are employed or their cousins own the factory. Sometimes at the university I walk around and I see people in such a small number of black people doing anything other than just maintenance. You know, I saw some guys cutting rock one day and I think, wow, you know, black people can't cut rock. You know, it's just they're just out of the trades. They're out of this. And I tell people to look. But once you become conscious, though, you really – it'll just hit you. You know, you'll never be free from it again. It's quite a burden. But you go to a construction site and you'll see maybe one black guy, maybe. You'll go see painters and you don't see anybody. Well, this has a bottom line effect. Those people aren't working, so they're not generating money, so they're not getting care of their families. They're not bringing money into their communities. And the net effect is poverty and all the things that go with it.
Have we gotten past the argument or the idea, the notion in mainstream American society and here in Pittsburgh that African Americans or any other minority group is less qualified to do these jobs? Are we still stuck on that?
I don't think we are so much in that. I mean, I think in the old days in the 30s or someplace, people used inferior arguments, sort of inferiority arguments. Well, they couldn't be quarterbacks, so they couldn't be all kinds of things,
right,
in the old days, right? I think people have abandoned that, but I think still structurally they're still in place that at one time they gave those rationales. But again, all of those rationales had the same purpose, to sustain advantage, and that's basically what's going on.
But if we're past – those notions, those antiquated ideas, then who has – you sort of alluded to this in a general way, but specifically, who would have a vested interest in excluding a perfectly capable group of people from being in their employ or being a part – an integral part of the workforce?
Well, part of it has been, of course, with segregation, that blacks have been shut out of it so long. But one, to answer that question a little bit, there was a great study that was done. And it's a person they studied, they sent out an application, and one white guy, one black guy. The white guy had a criminal record on the application. The black guy did not. Black guys with a criminal record got called back. I mean, white guys with criminal records got called back more than black guys without one. So, I mean, that there is this selective bias that goes on. There is still a lot of bias that's happening in society. So people choose people they want, they know. They call their relatives. They call their friends. So it's kind of networking. If you think about it, you know, you can see how it would happen in the sense that we hire people we know. We hire people we're comfortable with. This, the segregation that's always been part of our society has really been a bad thing. It's locked people out, not just of housing in schools, but also learning about the culture, also learning networking. You don't have the network. You don't know. Everybody you know, for example, some of the data you find about kids in school, that most of the kids that black kids go to school with are poor. Most of the kids that white kids go to school with are not poor. So, I mean, you have a group that doesn't know. They can't help you either. You know, so the real difference when people want to compare sometimes, you know, white poor and black poor, the major difference there is that black poor are surrounded by other black poor people. The average white person who's poor is not surrounded by other white people who are poor.
We are talking with Dr. Larry Davis about a recent report put out by the University of Pittsburgh's Center on Race and Social Problems, looking at racial disparities in the city of Pittsburgh and the ways that they adversely affect minority populations in the city. And I think that, and again, our number is 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002. In the last several decades, certainly in the decade of the 60s and to some extent in the 70s, we saw a great deal of social upheaval,
yeah.
Civil rights, yeah. Ordinances that addressed hiring disparities that made it the law that you know there had to be consideration for equal opportunity.
Right.
You would think that with the combination of that and also in the city of Pittsburgh, where it's worse, where things are actually worse for minorities than in other parts of the country, that, you know, this, in spite of these inherent biases, that part of our kind of our whole cultural being here in Pittsburgh is this awareness of the lore of championship sports teams, which,
yeah.
if nothing else, illustrate the value of diversity.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about, in particular, white and African-American athletes who come together to achieve great things.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think that that would somehow seep into our mindset in this city?
Well, you know, one of the good things I think has happened from that is they mentioned the Rooney Rule. I thought that was a great rule to have, that, you know, when you're hiring someplace, you know, do you have minorities in the application pool. I think you should always consider that.
You're referring to the rule that was named for either Dan or Art Rooney. Actually,
yeah,
I'm trying to remember
which one.
Yeah. But the Rooney family that owns the Steelers. This is the rule that you must interview a certain number of minority candidates for coaching jobs, for executive positions,
right.
That kind of
thing. There should be at least somebody in the pool to consider them. You know, some of the studies that have been done. One of the most interesting ones was done with the military. And this guy said, well, you know, you don't have to hire or promote, in this case, promotion. You don't have to promote black people, but you have to tell me why you didn't if you don't.
Mm.
And that awareness of it really increased significantly the number that were hired. This is a problem not just for Pittsburgh. It's a problem for the country. It's not just a problem for pro teams. It's a problem for universities. I spent a lot of time at universities. We have the same issues. The numbers are down, not just here in Pittsburgh. The numbers are down around the country. Because the same sort of dynamic, the military has probably done the best job in part because they take out discretion. In other words, you can't just decide this guy's a rank. You got to follow orders. That, you know, it's you can't do a buddy thing so much there. This guy gets so many stars or whatever it is he gets. That's it. So we pull some of that out. But here, where you can make decisions to hire your friends or not, or promote your friends or not, blacks aren't in the network. They're not married into the major system, so they're left out.
Let's talk about the data and the information that was used to put this report together. Where do these numbers come from?
I tell people that, you know, I don't like these numbers. I mean, people might think I might like them. I don't. I simply report reality. I do not construct it. These are census data. The Center on Race and Social Problems, which I'm the director of, as you mentioned, you know, basically has seven areas it looks at. Education, economics, families, criminal justice, intergroup relations. And basically, it's sort of we pull census data that sort of looks at that a little bit. But basically, this is not something we cooked up. This is not a study that we went out and did and said, aha, we're biased, our sample is biased. No, all we did was go to the census data, pull these data out for Pittsburgh, the county, the region, and compare that to the country. So this is just regular old census data.
412-246-2002 if you want to join our conversation with Dr. Larry Davis, who, again, is the dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work and director of its Center on Race and Social Problems, about the study that found these disparities between blacks and whites in Pittsburgh, members of Pittsburgh's black community, finding much more in the way of challenges in terms of employment and health care. Also, there are disparities in incarceration rates, which we'll get to. But first, let's take a call from Chuck in Tarentum. Chuck, welcome. All right, we lost Chuck, unfortunately, but we'll get to some other calls. There was a question that came to mind as we were talking, Dr. Davis, and as I look at you sitting across from me, a man who is you're the dean of a very prominent part of the University of Pittsburgh, the School of Social Work. Mm-hmm. As an African American man, what was the path that you followed? How did you get to where you are?
You know, this is a question. I have a book that I've been working on for years, and that's one of the questions that people ask. You know, you can do it. You prove to others can do it. It's like I hit the lottery. The odds on me being where I am are astronomical. I mean, I'm the only one of my friends who graduated from high school. And most of the people that people see running around here, most of the black people professionals, they're deviants, positive deviants in this case, but they're outliers in the data. And it's even hard. Black people even have trouble passing on their advantage to the next generation. I work. People say, "Well, did you work hard?" Yeah, I worked hard, but not really that much harder than anybody else. I mean, things worked for me. I could have gotten stopped by the police some place, some night. If you stop a guy enough times, you'll catch him doing something. Either he's had too many drinks or something. So if you're profiling people and you're stopping people all the time, well, naturally you're going to find that they're doing well. Everyone's doing something sometime in their life they probably shouldn't be doing, and so you catch those people. So fortunately, nothing ever happened to me. I never got, was drinking or never had a fight or things worked. I had good mentors. I had a family. We were in an all-black. We were in a segregated community. I was thinking this the other day. I can't think of anybody on my neighborhood, on my block, who went to college. One of my colleagues asked me once. We were at another university. And she said, "Do you know anybody in prison?" And I thought, my God. Here we both are, standing here at this university, both endowed professors. I know more people who went to prison than who went to college. I'm very deviant in that sense. It happened, So I don't like that when I get that question. I'm glad you asked that. But what I don't like about that question is the implicit assumption sometimes is that, aha, you're proof that it can be done. Why can't the others do it? It's almost like I feel like saying, well, some guy hit the lottery. Why don't you go hit the lottery? I mean, the odds on your being there are so astronomical. Why don't you have those odds?
I appreciate what you're saying, but it certainly makes sense, everything that you're saying. But isn't there something that you did that you, in terms of your determination?
Yeah, let me tell you this one story. I have this book that I told you I'm working on, and the question is, do you know anybody in prison? I was about 12 years old. We got stopped by the cops one night. A friend of mine and I we saw the police come, and we were these 12-year-old kids. We ran. Oh, so the cop turns around, picks us up, drives us around the neighborhood for a couple hours. You know, talking, "Why are you kids? So and so and so and so." We hadn't done anything. We were terrified. But anyway, we were embarrassed more than anything else because this is our neighborhood. So after about 2 hours, he got on the phone, and called in the station and said, "I got two kids. I'm gonna take them to the juvenile home." Well, the guy said, "It's full. There was no room in the inn. The only reason my friend and I didn't wind up in the juvenile home was because there was no more room. They didn't take us home. They didn't tell us, shake their finger at us and tell us we were bad kids or we shouldn't be out. It wasn't that late. You know, we just got stopped. So it's just a break. It didn't have to go that way. So there was a case. Now, if that had happened, who knows? I'd have gone. It may have changed my whole life trajectory. I mean, I'd have gone to juvenile home. Then maybe next week I really did do something. You know, so there we are off to the races now. So, yeah, I mean, I was reasonably smart, I guess, but not really that smarter than anybody else. I mean, I don't really feel that way. I always bugs me when these guys get up on stage or wherever they are and they take all this credit and sort of say, I'm standing on the shoulders of so many people who came before me. I really am. I mean, these guys want to say, oh, yeah, I'm this guy, I'm smart, and I worked hard. Well, yeah, okay, I did. I'm reasonably intelligent. I had good social. If I had attributes to something that helped me a lot, that I had decent social skills. I made a lot of friends, and I made a lot of white friends. I had the ability to sort of to do that, and I wasn't a threat. Perhaps I'm not a big guy, and I was, I guess, funny enough that they said, "Okay, come on, you can come with us." And I learned all sorts of cultural things that I wouldn't have learned otherwise. I learned stuff that white people knew. So when I got to college, you know, I did want to go to college. I had parents who wanted to go, but a lot of parents want their kids to go to college. It just doesn't work out for them. So I think that people look for that. I'm against resiliency, sometimes called resiliency research. What I feel we do sometimes, we take 100 kids, we hit them on the head with a baseball bat, find out which 5 don't have a fractured skull, and then say, okay, we're going to make the other 95 like this 5. And my question is, why do these kids... We only talk about resiliency stuff for black and poor kids or minority and poor kids. Why do these kids need to be so resilient in order to live an ordinary life? So why does someone need to be just an exceptional person, either through luck or talent, to have mediocre outcomes?
We're talking with Dr. Larry Davis. He's Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, Director of its Center on Race and Social Problems, about their recent study, the results showing a disparity between blacks and whites in employment rates. Employment rates for blacks in Pittsburgh, much lower. Poverty rates, much higher. And health and incarceration issues that we will address. We have much more left in our conversation, but we do need to take a break. You're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about a study that was released by the University of Pittsburgh's Center on Race and Social Problems, a report highlighting racial disparities affecting the quality of life for Pittsburgh's black community. It found that there were a lack of opportunities to obtain sufficient employment among people of minority backgrounds as compared to whites in Pittsburgh, as well as a disparity when it came to being adequately educated and live in good neighborhoods compared to white people. And that report was just released last week. It was a follow-up report on a study initially released in 2007. And yet, in those 8 years, not much has changed. So we're addressing that with Dr. Larry Davis. He's Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work and Center, and Director of its Center on Race and Social Problems. And he's with us here in Studio A. If you have a comment or question in this segment, 412-246-2002 is the number to call to get in to the conversation, and the email address ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Dr. Davis, we were talking earlier, and you mentioned that one of the problems that we're finding in terms of why these disparities exist is that people tend to hire and support their friends, meaning majority whites in Pittsburgh are engaging in that practice. If people tend to hire and support their friends and people they know, is there something that can be done at the school level to change the diversity of young people's social circles?
Well, that's tough. I think you're going to have to create a situation where people are sort of required to interact. It's kind of like what we did with the civil rights movement. You know, people sort of say, well, you know, you can't legislate morality. But in fact, we did. When you made it illegal for people not to be nice to people, people stopped being bad to people. And their attitudes went with it. Now people are much more civil towards each other. I mean, I think they really have been. Despite a report of this kind, there really has been significant improvement in terms of a number of areas. I mean, the fact that I'm dean says something. I might not have been the dean 50 years ago. There are a number of, you have a black president, of course, which is a big deal that people make a lot of hay about that. I think that's true. So there has been some, but we just have to do more of it. Most people are just not really kind of aware of it. And there's also the questions you asked, I think, from the beginning. These are long, ongoing structural problems. For example, there's an article that I recommend everyone read. It was by Coates. It was in the Atlantic Monthly. That issue sold more copies of Atlantic Monthly magazine than any other issue. It was called A Case for Reparations. And he's not really arguing for reparations, but he talks about how the economic disparity, and I guess maybe at some point you were probably going to go there, the economic disparities existed. How did we get in this situation? How do we have, some of the people will sort of say, they want to argue class. Well, how do you get the class disparities? We got the class disparities because of the racial effect. It didn't come the other way. It wasn't class that created the racial effects. It was the race effects that created the class effects. So, but basically there were three things that he points out that sort of started us on this track, and of course, slavery was one. You had people completely disenfranchised. And most people aren't aware how long slavery took place. 246 years, 2.5 centuries. I mean, people think about slavery like we do the civil rights movement or the Vietnam War or something, but it was kind of limited, a decade, 13 years, 20 years, maybe. No, if you were born in it, you were just in it. I mean, this country was a slave country, long as it's been a free country. And most people are completely unaware of that. So you had people who had no skills, no skills except what they were doing, maybe agriculture or something. No sense of who they were, a family structure completely. I mean, you really had. And then you say, okay, now take off, guys. You guys free to go. Free to go where? So anyway, it's kind of, we sort of still have, people who have strong culture, Italians, Jews, people, think about the cultures, how it's important for them. Well, suppose you pull that culture out of there. And they, they didn't have that. They didn't have a sense. And I tell this to people, this is the difference between immigrants and blacks. And then one of the chapters in this book that I've written is called Why Blacks Can't Be Like Immigrants. First of all, because they're not. They're not immigrants.
They did not choose.
Initially. That's right. And they didn't come intact. Most immigrants may have come with empty pockets, but they didn't come with empty heads. They knew things. They had human capital. They're bakers, plumbers, craftsmen, stone workers. I mean, they had some skills. They had a sense of who they were as a people. They had a sense of identity. This was another thing. When, emancipation took place, this wasn't the case. It's like I tell people sometimes when I'm on the road, I'll talk to people, I'll say, if this us group of Americans, say sometimes a dozen or so, if we were to leave here and someone said, okay, folks, you can only leave with the money in your pocket. That's it. The $12 we have or whatever you got in your pocket, we're going to go to the coast of some poor country. When we got there, with just the clothes on our backs and a couple of bucks we had in our pockets, in a relatively short time, we would be far better off than the indigenous poor the country went to, because we have tremendous human capital. We could teach school. We could manage money. We know how to do things. We have information that the indigenous poor people don't have. So when people make these comparisons, my uncles came and we worked hard. But yeah, they came. They were the most motivated of the population. When you get ready to get on a boat and say goodbye to everybody you love, with the odds of not ever seeing them again, you got to be really motivated. So you're talking about, and we talk even about Asians in the country. You have a billion Chinese. I mean, we're creaming. I mean, we're getting people who come from good families. So whenever they make this idea, this comparison, comparing a really often the elite of a country, they may be poor, but they have a lot of human capital to come to America. Compare it with a population that doesn't have that, it's a grossly unfair comparison. And that's what I'd like people to sort of think about. And probably is, I think, sometimes that immigrants don't think of it that way either. They think, well, I'm here and they're here. Why aren't they doing better? Because they came intact. They knew who they were even as a people. So it's really – but there were three things the Coates article did that I thought was great. One, blacks never really benefited from the GI Bill. They didn't benefit from the GI Bill because the southern states would only agree to the GI Bill if it could be state-run. Most blacks lived in the states. Most blacks didn't get benefit from the GI Bill. So even when they went, the biggest social program that happened for whites in the country was the GI Bill. They got a big deal from that. The second, so people.
They had a lot of people to go to college.
They had a lot of people to go to college. So blacks didn't do that because the states wouldn't do that. So none of them, hardly any of them, benefited from the GI Bill. You had Social Security. Well, again, the southern states would only agree to Social Security if it did not include farmers and domestics.
So, if you were underemployed, you couldn't pay into it, and so you couldn't take advantage of it.
Yeah, if you were a farmer or domestic, who was farmers and domestics? Most black people were farmers and domestics. And the other thing that happened was something with the FHA, where they were their redlined communities, where they wouldn't put money into those communities, wouldn't sell them. A case in point, when my mom died, she bought a house in the 1950s. When she died, I had to literally give the house away. I had no net worth on the house. The black community, nobody put any money back into it. It had been redlined for decades. So, I mean, you kind of have that. I think if I had been someplace else and someone, I don't know, my mom paid for the house, but certainly it would be worth something in 50 years. It was worth nothing. I gave it to Catholic Charities.
412-246-2002, the number to call if you would like to join our conversation with Dr. Larry Davis. And we have Denise in Pittsburgh on the line. Denise, hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm curious that Dr. Davis has not used the terms of white privilege and institutional racism, because I believe both of those are key components to the numbers that appear in the report. And I'm just curious as to his choice of words.
Well, it's just that. It's just a choice of words. You know, I agree. What you're talking about is the effect of the discrimination. That is, it provides a group that the group that's discriminated against doesn't have the privilege, and the group that exercises it has a privilege because they keep people out. So you can always think of it this way. When some group is disadvantaged, another group is advantaged. So, yeah, I think you're right. A lot. It's white, basically what white have as benefits are privileges. I mean, they have privileges to buy what they want. One of the things we know about income, for example, distribution, is that income has not afforded blacks the integration into society that it has other groups. That even those blacks who make middle income salaries really still live within a primarily black community or bordering on one. It hasn't really served to move them more integratedly into society. So, but I agree with your thing. The institutional problems are exactly right. I mean, it isn't all just volitional, someone hiring their friends. That we have had policies, and we do support them still. There's still biases against hiring blacks in other places.
Denise, thank you.
I believe people are aware that they are participants in these numbers continuing to show up, because most people aren't really aware of the significance of white privilege and how they help perpetuate it.
Well, I agree that you can't. I mean, we can blame them, but you can understand why they would not. I mean, in other words, it's not something I've learned a long time ago. It's hard to convince someone of something if it's in their economic interest not to be convinced.
Denise, thank you for that phone call. Dr. Davis, Pittsburgh's economy has done well in recent years, coinciding with this study, if you go back to the original study in 2007. So why haven't African Americans been able to benefit from this?
Well, part of it, you have a population that, you know, was really tied to manufacturing. The major gains that have occurred in Pittsburgh in recent years have not had so much to do with manufacturing. They're high tech, they're universities, they're hospitals. You know, we're information center. It's really high-end kind of development that's taking place. Blacks were never in a position to sort of take advantage of those opportunities, and they're still not. And that's the problem now about the educational problems. To the extent that they're left behind, these problems will exacerbate themselves.
I mentioned health disparities, and also while blacks and whites have comparable drug use rates in Pittsburgh, blacks have a higher arrest rate. What about this?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like the story I talked to you about. You know, if you stop enough people, mm-hmm. profile enough people, well, you'll catch more of that group because everybody's doing the same thing, but one group's being stopped more for all sorts of other suspicions. So if we had comparable stop rates, stop and frisk rates, we'd probably have comparable rates of incarceration. But also there's bias, too, in terms of just incarceration rate, length of sentencing, the number of the criminal justice system really has some work to do.
And, you know, before we wrap this up, I think it's important to talk about how do we begin to try to solve this problem and address these inequities. You have a new mayoral administration in Pittsburgh.
Which I'm very pleased with, by the way.
Mayor Peduto, cited by many as a progressive mayor. Is there more of a likelihood things will change under his leadership?
I think so. I'm on a committee with him, and he said something that really impressed me. He said, you know, in the past, people made decisions that they didn't consider how it would influence all segments of society. We might put a highway through one community. We might build a stadium in one community. And we weren't sort of aware that, hey, this is going to have negative impact on the people who live there. I think his awareness of that will help the city a great deal. What you're doing here today is really what has to happen. People just don't think about it. There are a lot of really good people who would do better if they knew what they could do. First, you have to acknowledge that you have a problem. And by your having me on the show and doing these kinds of things is exactly that point.
Well, it's certainly been our honor to have you and to have this conversation, and hopefully it will be the first of many. Dr. Larry Davis, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, Director of its Center on Race and Social Problems. Thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, thank you for having me. It was an honor to be here.